So, let's see. The methodological principles and pedagogic procedures. The first question was, do you think that the distinction is a good one?
Yes, because you went from the essentially, as I see it, from the theory to the practice. In the practice, in such a book, I don't think it can be prescribed in such a way, not knowing the local context, not knowing the students themselves. And so, in the same way that Long talks about how the target of task-based teaching is the local context, and therefore, course books can't. They can't really focus on, instead of being generic and wide and not really focused, the task-based language teaching approach takes as its foundation, I think, a focus on the local environment and the local situation, circumstances, and whatnot. In the same way as the main fundament of task-based learning teaching is, I think it's not possible for a prescription to be given pedagogically.
Yes, right. But what about the 10 methodological principles, which are, he says, kind of universal, and really, by extrapolation from that, you'd say they can be applied to any teaching course, not just TBLT.
Yeah, I agree. Another three of them, I've left my book in the other room. The long book in the other room. So
I have mine with me as always.
just one moment and I'll be.
not sure if this is being recorded. We are recording this, Stephen. Yeah, so it's chapter 10, page 301, where he says that the methodological principles are universally desirable instructional design features motivated by theory and research findings in SLA, education psychology, philosophy of education, general education of design, and elsewhere, which show them to be either necessary for SLA or facilitative. And I think that's, he underlines that facilitative effects are important because the goal of a theory of LT is a maximally efficient approach, whereas a theory of SLA is primarily concerned with what is necessary and sufficient for learning.
And that's what he was saying in the, that's what I think that's what he was saying in the recording
Yes.
earlier on in the course.
Yes. Yeah. And so when we go through them, he says that the 10 of them constitute sort of the what of teaching. So you've got use task, not text, and so on and so on. Elaborate input, provide rich input, focus on form, not blah, blah, blah. So those are the whats. But he says then, as you've just said yourself, that the pedagogic procedures recognize that really any implementation of any course has to be done at a local level, and the teacher carrying that implementation out is the one that has to be trusted to decide on the pedagogic procedures. So the pedagogic procedures are, how do you implement the methodological principles? That seems to me a very good distinction. There's in a lot of previous works on syllabus design, there's always this question of is this a methodology or is it an approach? Is CLT a methodology or is PPP or this or that? And I think that by making this distinction between universal or putatively universal principles and then local pedagogic procedures, that does seem to me to be a pretty useful distinction to make. And so when you're talking to people who argue, and people like, I don't know, those who argue for a coursebook-driven syllabus, a basic sort of PPP methodology, or those who argue for a lexical approach like Hugh Deller, or those who argue for dogma, for example. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that one can use these principles and procedures to kind of, evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of each one. The bloody dog's cracking the door down. Hang on. I saw in the discussion thing, it's what is one of the questions there? It says, do you think the distinction between this and that is viable? Oh no, I think it says, do you think pedagogic procedures gives teachers a carte blanche?
No. I think that should be fairly obvious.
Yeah.
With the methodology rather than the approach, as you say, needing to be based on some research-derived fundaments, then you're going to have to, when you are implementing the pedagogic procedures, they have to reflect those key parts of the methodology itself. So when you're looking at the elaboration and modification, etc., when you're looking at the rich input, something that I read that Neil was replying to my, I chose the rich input, provide rich input number four. And Neil replied to me this morning about it's important to have task focused or context focused material and not just lots and lots of material that isn't really targeted at the particular domain in which people are either developing or wanting to develop in. And I think it's necessary to follow that targeted approach rather than thinking that you're going to throw a lot of material at a student and hopefully some of it sticks.
Yeah, yes, quite so. Yeah. So we agree then that these are kind of useful. When we get onto them, he does this table on table 10.1 on pages 302 and 303, where he shows the sources for in the literature for each one. So it's typically for Long. He's keen to show that all these principles have support from the SLA literature.
And that they are relatively recent as well.
Yes, they are. They're quite right. He's very good at keeping up to date in that sense. And of course, a lot of his work has been done through the years with Kathy Doughty, his partner, and a lot of other bloody good people. So I noticed there at the end of page 303, he says, to say that teachers are best suited to make decisions on pedagogic procedures does not imply that methodologists abdicate responsibility at the classroom level. Choices should be rational based on teaching experience and, where available, research findings. And then he gives the example of Kathy Doughty and of a continuum of choices.
I've tried to find that paper and I can't find it at all.
No. Ah, really? With the Doughty and Williams?
Yeah.
I'll find that for you and I'll put it up on the thing. I've got that.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll gaily say, oh, I'll do it, and I forget immediately. So Doughty and Williams,
1998.
Yeah. Okay, I'll put that up tonight. Thank you. And then at the end there, I was looking at this morning, and I've almost forgotten those. He does include evaluation criteria to evaluate the methodological principles.
Yeah.
And help us, so that if we are comparing, let's say, some version of Hugh Deller's, lexical approach. I'm not having a go at it, I promised Neil and everybody else that I won't. But so just take it as a perfectly acceptable alternative. So if you say, well, here's what Deller's syllabus looks like. What are the principles that inform it, and can we evaluate it using Long's thing? I think we can. Mm-hmm. Here he says on page 304, the evaluation criteria for the methodological principles are the standards by which proposals can be judged, the ways in which these are likely to validity can be assessed. The evaluation criteria can take several forms, including, most obviously, the first one, theoretical motivation.
Yeah.
To what extent does it chime with theoretical models of SLA? Two, empirical support. What evidence is there from research that it that supports it? And third, logical argumentation. So those are the classic three that you would expect to find. But they are there, and I think they do make a good background for it. And I like this thing. His illustration is in the case of methodological principle 7, provide negative feedback. There's a lot of core. I mean, that's one of his huge areas that Long is particularly associated with. His negotiation of meaning and so on is part of that. And it's the kind of root of his insistence on focus on form, not focus on forms. Mm-hmm. But he does actually back it up. I think he backs it up very well. And if you were to do that and compare that to the way Deller teaches through his, I have to say, I lift my hat to him for actually sharing videos of himself teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very brave and very good of him to allow us to watch somebody in action. But what you see there is this, I think, tremendous reliance on explicit teaching. Deller seems to think that's the teacher's job, is to try and get through as many lexical chunks as possible. You know, you get through 30 or less, and that's terrific. And it always strikes me as such a hopelessly lost cause when you think that we need, 9,000 are often chosen, 9,000 families, not just lexical chunks, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But anyway, you say, well, that's what it does. You know, okay, today's lesson, we're going to look at something, some text or something. And the aim of it is to get the students to learn this number of this lexis or these lexical chunks or. And then you say, well, how does that actually back up with what we know about the way people learn? Does it? And then these three evaluation criteria, what's its theoretical motivation? It's some awful misinterpretation of Hoey, basically, that informs Deller. What's the empirical evidence that supports it? Absolutely none. In fact, there's a mountain of evidence to show it's not a very efficacious way. And what's the logical argumentation? Well, unfortunately, he's not terribly good at that. So at least it does show, you can use it as a kind of way of, and then if you look, for example, at, let's look at, lower intermediate, headway, for example, what do they do? So I think it is quite a good way of setting up a rational, reasonable way of assessing different courses. And I think that's its main aim. The main aim of the methodological principles is to say, my teaching is informed by coherence with what we know of the theory of language learning. It's supported by the research and it's logically argued. So that's the sort of case you can make for it. And it's a case that can be used to evaluate competition, like for example, you know, the other content language instruction or dogme or whatever it is. But I suppose really the most important thing for us as we're, you know, working through it is probably more that it's the pedagogical procedures. That's really the nuts and bolts of it. It's very good to have the methodological principles to support it. But in the end, I think really it's the pedagogical principles, particularly, you know, focus on form, elaborated input, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's the real nitty gritty.
Something that one of the questions for the that we were asked to think about, and in fact, it forms the focus of the output task. Question 10 is the NP5, encourage inductive chunk learning.
Ah, yes.
And I know this is perhaps because even in Long, even he concedes that more research needs to be done on this particular thing. I'm wondering whether it's possible to get, I'm hoping that it's not possible to get less than 50% on this particular output. But I was wondering, thinking about that particular way of doing, because it's very important. I mean, I've been having a look at I was looking at this and I've just been starting to read in anticipation of trying to answer and reference the output task, the Paul Nations chapter on teaching and testing vocabulary. And where he talks about the core idioms, I think there are about he said there are about 1,000 they've found core idioms. Then beyond the core idioms, the figurative multi-word items or chunks, and then the literal chunks beyond that as well.
Yeah.
At where I am in trying to understand it is...
Sorry, so just one second. Ginny, I'm in the middle of a video conference. Sorry. Yes, sorry, where were we? We were talking about... Put the book up again, just so that everybody knows where we are. This is the marvellous Handbook of Language Education, Doughty and Long.
Yeah.
What is it, 2004?
2009, I think.
2009, yeah. It's just that much. Yeah, okay. So from that, you're talking about Nation. There's an article, there's a chapter.
Yeah, his chapter is on page 543.
Right. And he's saying, in terms of vocabulary acquisition, what does he say?
Well, essentially for the multi-word units, which is where I've started concentrating on, he's talking about how there are four major productive effects of learning multi-word units. The first one being producing grammatically correct utterances. The second, produce utterances that are native-like. Third, producing utterances fluently. And fourth, to communicate very early in their language learning using chunks rather than trying to piece the together. But he also goes on to say about how it seems to be, as you were saying, trying to teach them explicitly. From what I understand from it, there are so many that it's so difficult to do. And what is I think he was saying Grant and Nation 2006 were tried to isolate the 100 core idioms. Sorry, I said 1,000 earlier. And separating them out from the figurative, which could perhaps be understood. The core idioms making no sense if translated literally into the one. The figurative being having some connection to the meaning of the words which comprise or compose the particular multi-word units, and then the literal, which should be hopefully straightforward. Yes. And he gives examples like two birds with one stone.
Two examples of those. The literal ones are obviously, one would suppose, the least troublesome, in that it's pretty obvious what they mean.
Yeah, yeah. But other things like kill two birds with one stone, he mentions about how it's not always, especially where kill, birds, and stone aren't within the same context of the particular text that's being read, it can sometimes throw learners off.
Yes.
Another one he mentions is we want to make sure we're singing from the same hymn sheet. He suggests are quite easy to interpret. And I know from the Polish side, I've given this figurative idiom before, just not after reading the book. And hymna is from hymn, so it's quite easy to make that to make that jump.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering here, because I've also, I don't know, and this is perhaps less of, I've also been coming up through these two.
Uh-huh.
Implementing the lexical approach.
Yeah, that's Michael Lewis, famous one.
And then the teaching collocations.
That's slightly more recent. Yeah.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I've read this one, the implementing lexical approach.
Yeah.
Started teaching, but I've not made my way all the way through this one.
Uh-huh.
The teaching collocations, should I say. And I was just having a look at how they also, I've lost where it's gone now. Jane Consett, chapter 4, integrating collocation into a reading and writing course, the need, 4.2, the need to build vocabulary. And she talks about the difference between explicit and implicit, or infer implicit learning of the words rather than explicit word card learning. And she cites a couple of Sockmen, I think. And then she goes on to talk about explicit vocabulary study. I've not read too much of it, to be honest, but still with the implementing lexical approach, where he talks about particular strategies, techniques, and things that you might give to make happen in the classroom. I was wondering what your thoughts are with your reading, because I've only read these few.
I was quite impressed with Mike Lewis's thing when it came out. He was with Jimmy Hall, a small publishing outfit they had, and Lewis wrote a tremendous book on the English verb.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Those diagrams that I included in the in the last one, they were taken and adapted from it.
Terrific stuff.
Yeah.
So he's no slouch. He always had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, a bit like his successor, Della, because he wasn't taken terribly seriously by the academic community.
Right.
But I think the basic problem with teaching lexically is it didn't really tell us, I mean, the pedagogical procedures. It stopped short. So these kind of grand statements like you can't get anywhere with just grammar, and language is basically collocational. All of this, he was a pioneer, and certainly the work that's been done since with big corpuses and corpora and the concordance programs we've got now, it certainly is absolutely undeniable, and that's why it's methodological principle number 5 in Long. Mm-hmm. Chunk learning is absolutely essential to language learning, to second language learning. There's no doubt about it. The trouble is, how the hell do you do it? And really, I think it's appalling that the Della and Woolley book on this. I mean, their course books that attempt to implement it are one thing. But they actually wrote a book,
Is it called?
I find it here.
Teaching Lexically, is that what it's called?
Yes, seriously.
Yeah. I have a copy of that, actually.
Teaching Lexically. And you look there, it says principles and practice. Now, you compare the principles of teaching lexically by Della and Walkley, the principles of how people learn are found on page seven. And it says, essentially, to learn any given item of language, people need to carry out the following steps.
Yeah.
Understand the meaning of the item. Hear an example of the item. Hear or see an example of the item in context. Approximate the sounds of the item. Pay attention to the item and notice its features. Do something with the item. Use it in some way. Repeat these steps over time when encountering the item again and in other contexts. And that's it. I mean, it's utterly hopeless.
I know, I've read your, is it a three-part?
Yes, I did. I wrote a review of the book on the blog.
Yeah.
See, that's the trouble. What on earth are you supposed to do with that in terms of syllabus design?
I'm sorry, Jeff. Go on.
He thinks we should just throw as many of these bloody items. You see, language learning consists of understanding the meaning of the item, getting an example of the item, approximate the sounds of the item, pay attention to the item. So, language consists of items, and these items can be dealt with one at a time. And accumulated. Now, this is the classic old idea of a synthetic syllabus taken to the atma. No understanding. I mean, it's just extraordinary. No attempt to provide proper support in the way that Long does in terms of an evaluation of its theoretical basis in SLA research, its support and its logical argument. Mm-hmm. So going back to, if that's no good, one of the biggest problems for Della, he never properly answered, is, all right, first of all, how, if you accept that you just don't have enough time to teach the lexical chunks that people need to be fluent users of the language. They're variously estimated, but Nation, for example, talks of word families at 9,000 for fluent conversation.
Yeah.
How on earth, 9,000? How many is that a day, etc. So, exactly as you say, Nation and other people, the first one, including Michael Lewis, and after that, Nattinger and the Carrico and so on, and then Sinclair with the Cobalt system, they said, well, the obvious thing to do is to do the most frequent. And what are the most frequent ones? Teach them first.
Does that make sense?
Well, does it that does make sense? To a certain extent. But the problem is that a lot of them are sort of used in so many different ways. So if you take one lexical type, its ramifications are huge. So, you know, Widdowson's done some good stuff on this, incidentally. I mean, there are all sorts of qualities that you need to consider when trying to cut down, trying to make the number of lexical chunks or formulaic pieces of language reduced enough to make it a practical proposition. Mm-hmm. Frequency, as exemplified in a big corpus study, so the COCA, for example, probably the biggest one. Mm-hmm. So if you say from that, okay, we're going to take, that's the way, what they did with the COBIL course of English was to base it on the vocabulary. The lexis, not the lexical chunks. Mm-hmm. One of the most 3,000 words in English account for 78% of all use. It's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it just falls off the radar. You have 3,000 words, or 2,000, I think it's 1,050%, 2,060%, 3,070%, and then, you know, most educated English speakers have got 30,000, God knows what the rest of them are. Mm-hmm. Because they're just not significantly, statistically significant. So it makes absolute sense, as Lewis and Cope and Sinclair and all of them said, let's concentrate on these very high frequency words. The problem with the words is that they were used, you know, get is one of them. How the hell do you teach get? Well, you can't. You have to start the lexical chunks, and how many get chunks are there, and so on and so on. So it's actually, and then there's a question of saliency, and then there's a question of valency, and there are various criteria by which one you know, can talk about what are the most important. And that's what Nation does, and that's what Brian Tomlinson and a lot of other people do. So, now, from Long, I think what Long makes a very good way of reducing this number by a needs analysis. So if you take a really good needs analysis, which it's the basis of Long's task-based language teaching, mm-hmm. then you identify the target tasks. So you say, okay, this course is for, I don't know, you know, the famous one for
people flight attendants,
air traffic control. So we know what they need, or the hotel receptionists. Let's take the air traffic control. We've got we've identified 6 or 7 or 10 tasks, 10 target tasks, and these are going to, we're going to make the syllabus from them. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? We break the target tasks down into pedagogic tasks. What do we need for the pedagogic tasks? We need elaborated texts. And it's in the elaborated text precisely where you choose the lexical chunks. And obviously there are absolutely key ones that you can identify. And I imagine, you know, you could actually say there are 100 key lexical chunks that all air traffic controllers need to know. Well, that's a tremendous start. And maybe there are 400 or 500 others. So at least there, you have a much better chance of making your lexical chunks relevant, rather than, again, Hugh Deller, he's got this every day. Have you seen it?
1 minute video, is it?
1 minute video. Now, I always say, what criteria inform his choice? It seems to me that it's just whatever happens to him during the day. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, I don't know, you know, stitching signs, I really can't remember what they are. And I was like, well, you know, what informs that? But he's now got more than 200. And there was a list recently that I made reference to on a tweet. And it just came out from, who was it? Cobalt? No. I think it used COCA, the big corpus. But anyway, it actually said, here are the 100 or the 200 most frequent collocational bits from this corpus. And not one of them was any, you know, Della's 300-400 now minutes. You know, you look on YouTube, he's got over 200.
Right.
Talks. I was talking to my daughter today, when she said, whatever, you know, some bit, some chunk, and you go, well, that's what informs that? What's it motivated by?
What's the relevance, yeah.
Particularly if we're talking of general English, you know. English for no apparent reason, or, you know, was it tenor teaching mm-hmm. English for no apparent reason? No obvious reason.
Yeah.
Tenor. So it just seems to me so ridiculous to just pluck things out of the air and then go into class and bang away at them
mm-hmm.
Without having given a lot of consideration to. First, which ones do you want to look at? And second, how do you do it? These are the first, which ones? And second, what do you do then? Do you actually go up and say, here's a really interesting collocational chunk that, really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you do what Long says, is you put it in elaborated texts. So these become written and recorded texts filled with the necessary chunks, and they are worked on as a task, rather than explicitly taught as a bit of, as an item, as Della calls them.
And then you have the repetition.
Yeah, and you build in the repetition, which of course Della is very keen on repetition, as he has to be, given that the whatever literature they rely on, I mean, it's skills acquisition theory, which is really, not got such a terribly good record. I mean, after at an elementary level, there's some evidence for it, but not much after that. And in any case, yes, some say 6 times, some say 9 times, some say 12 times, 12 repetitions needed in different, So how on earth are you supposed to recycle 9,000 words? It's absurd. And Mike puts his hands up and says, how incredibly important they are. But it's a bit on page 308, he says, the size and scope of the collocations problem can be appreciated by considering findings of the presumably lesser task of word learning.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a problem with word learning, it's exponentially greater if we're talking about chunks. Nation 2006, Nation and Chung 2009 calculated that learners require knowledge of between 6,000 and 7,000 word families for adequate comprehension of speech and 9,000 for reading. I mean, and as he says, you know, obviously you can't deal with that. Now, one thing that, of course, Krashen is very big on is extensive reading outside class.
Yeah.
And I think that's a tremendous suggestion, that teachers should say to all their learners, you're going to read outside class.
Mm-hmm.
Form a reading club with a library, relevant books. When I was teaching at ISADI, became the director of studies there, 70 teachers, and we said to them all, we've got to encourage everybody to do lots and lots of extensive reading. And about 2/3 of the teachers say, I can't do that. It's just too much to ask. They won't do it. And why? Because they didn't believe in it.
Right.
They didn't really see how terribly important it was.
Yeah.
That there were a few teachers, one in particular, Jerry Sweeney, he was absolutely on for it. And all his bloody learners did it. Why? Because he persuaded them. Mm-hmm. He said, I promise you this will work, but you've got to read, leave the dictionary in the bedroom. Don't, read as you read in your own language. If it's too difficult, throw it away and find something, and so on and so on and so on. We're talking extensive reading here. We're interested in the message. Of course, you can take a couple of notes if you want, but if you slow down too much, you've lost the trick. Mm. Extensive reading. We want a novel a week, and we're going to do a novel a week, and we're going to talk about it. Now, that I think would have a tremendous. That's one way of trying to deal with the seemingly impossible problem of people getting enough exposure to collocational language. And another way that Long says is a combination of reading and writing. I don't know if you have you seen his two suggestions. I've just seen here on page 311, he says the $64,000 question is how to best facilitate collocational learning.
Yeah.
Collocations can be noticed not only because of the salience and the frequency provides, This is Nick Ellis now is very on board with this idea that we should, when choosing collocations, frequency should be the number one reference. Collocations can be noticed not only because of the saliency that frequency provides, but instantaneously as a result of conscious attention, after which the usual procedure, implicit tallying, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I've underlined that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, that, this is something that Nick Ellis is really keen on now, and I think Mike Ellis, it's interesting. Sorry, Mike Long. Both of them, so I personally don't, I don't buy it. But Mike Long obviously has bought it, and Nick Ellis.
You don't buy.
No, I don't think. You see what they're basing themselves on is basically Dick Schmidt's noticing hypothesis.
Okay.
And I don't believe it. I don't take it. He had to, and of course, again, you get. Hugh Deller, you know, noticing is, and he's talking about conscious noticing. With him, there's no, totally contradicts what Hoey says. And Dick Schmidt himself has had to, as a result of lots of criticism of his original one, where he said noticing was the sufficient condition for learning. He now admits that implicit unconscious learning is possible. You don't have to notice everything in order to, you know, I mean, of course, it was inevitable. He had to backtrack. Yeah. So now what Nick Ellis is saying, you know, when Nick Ellis takes a constructivist, emergentist view of language learning. So he dismisses Chomsky. He dismisses the need for any UG or for, and he says it's a statistical question. You can get it from the environment. There's enough information in the environment to explain language learning, which is, in my opinion, bollocks. So what Ellis is saying, I mean, he doesn't dismiss mind as the real mad, you know, empiricists do. He says, yes, there is this. And what happens is that we are tuned for our first language. When we learn a second language, we expect what we expect from our first language.
Yeah.
And that makes us fragile learners. There are parts of the L2 that we're trying to learn that we don't notice. Why? Either because they're not salient, things like third person S, that don't matter. They don't, you know, if you say ego, everybody understands, so, and so on. Or they have low density, or low frequency, and so on and so on. For a number of reasons, says Nick Ellis, certain bits of the new language, certain fragile features of the target language, will not be picked up in the way that most of the language will. So he's saying that the default way that you learn an L2 is the same as the way you learn an L1. You pick it up. It's implicit. That's still it. But unfortunately, because of the experience of learning the first language, you become fragile learner, and after certain windows of sensitive periods, you won't pick up various bits of pronunciation and so on and so on. And that is where noticing comes in. Mm. But it's not hit them over the head like Della does. That's not what he means by noticing. You know, again. Okay. I can't think of
it. Yeah, as a teacher, I suspect it's less. What we're talking about here is less, like you were saying, notice this. It's more about the learner than
what he's saying here on page two. What Long says, Nick Ellis says, is that what you have to do is reset the dial. So what you have to do, what students have to do, in order to learn these fragile features that they won't pick up in the way that they pick up everything else, is draw their attention to it once. And this resets the dial, after which the default is it here. Nick Ellis recognizes instantaneously as a result of conscious attention, all right, once. Mm-hmm. That conscious attention, brackets, after which the usual process of implicit tallying applies thereafter to the chunk itself, with frequency again determining being a determining factor. So this is, I mean, I don't get it, but
is this not the initial imprint on the mind being made deeper and deeper by more frequent?
That's right. What he says is, what Nick Ellis says, and what Mike Long now buys into, is the question, in fact, both of them, both Nick Ellis and Mike Long, are still not absolutely sure that noticing is necessary. They're still, I won't have it. I think Nick Schmidt's thing is full of holes. I think Susan Carroll is much better on it, and I still think
I haven't read her book yet. Her input of evidence, is it?
Bloody difficult. I mean, she really, you know, nobody reads her because she's just a damn difficult, but she's utterly brilliant. I think far the best. I mean, the best. See, what she says is input, even input. You know, what we really do is we monitor a stream of sound, and we recognize stuff in that stream. And in order to do that, in my opinion, you must have some innate mechanism going on there. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense of it. And so really, it's not comprehensible input. It's making sense of the stream. You do not notice grammar. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make sense to notice rules.
Yeah.
You notice noise. You mm-hmm. notice smells. You notice touch. That's what empirical input. You know, you do not notice an adjective. You know, it's an oxymoron. How could you possibly notice the present tense bollocks? It's nonsense. Mm-hmm. And it just gets through. You know, you don't. You know, it's not. It's nonsense. Of course. Dick Schmidt notices it because he's a highly intelligent, supremely clever, bloody linguist. And so when he's learning Portuguese, which he bases his work on, of course he notices, that's a good, you know. but most people don't. That's not what happens. It's just not what happens. But in any case, even given their view, which you could accept, it means once. You have to notice once, and then that's laid down.
Right.
Once it's gone into long-term memory, it's gone through the buffer, short-term memory, it's been noticed, and bang, it's down there. After that, the normal default mechanism of implicit learning takes over again, once it's there. So that's a trick. I think it's a very polished, clever, shiny bit of... I don't buy it. But anyway, even there, what they're all saying, everybody now agrees, apart from, you know, the obvious candidates, everybody agrees that basically language learning is implicit. And the best way to do it is scaffold the use of tasks where people are, la, 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 what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I think here what he says, very worth us all reading very carefully, as you underlined yourself, is in the methodological principle, number 5.
Yeah.
That methodological principle tend encourage inductive chunk learning. It's very interesting that he spends a long time on that. I mean, you know, I don't know how many pages, but... more than 10. And his two suggestions are really interesting. Have you read it? He says, I don't know, you know, still the $64,000 question.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't got the answer to it. But I've got, he makes two suggestions.
He talks about the bimodal on page 313, doesn't he? About reading and listening at the same time.
He's got on page 313, he says, my own two suggestions are as follows.
Yeah.
But each comes with the caveat that, to the best of my knowledge, little or no empirical research has been conducted on either. Mm-hmm. First, whenever possible, add an extensive reading and listening program.
Yeah.
So that was my suggestion, but he makes it, you know, my suggestion to teachers when I was at DOS was, whatever you're doing, whatever book you're using, whatever method, because it was, everybody was, you know, there were 100 things going on. Whatever you're doing, build in an additional reading program on top of it, mm-hmm. outside class. And he's suggesting that you do an extensive reading and listening program. Mm-hmm. Notice first, it's extensive. So you're not studying the language. You know, okay, what's this word mean? What's another word for that? It's extensive. Yeah. But it's listening and reading at the same time. And he makes the case that, a little bit further down, in addition, the spoken version should be a case of enhanced spoken input.
Yeah, I read about the pauses before. Yeah,
pause for a second, they repeat. Yeah. You know, they motherese kind of stuff. You know, they're really laying it on with a trowel, giving you every damn opportunity to, you know, to hear it more than once, hear it slowed down, and you're reading along with it. And the second one is really nice, which is on page 314. He calls it
plagiarism.
Plagiarism. I think it's really great. We won't bother about it here, but I mean, that's someone who's really, you know, I mean, that's a very, very practical thing. And I would suggest to everybody that they would be well, and I'm sure the students would love it. And it's a great activity. Now, of course, it doesn't solve the problem, you know, of quite how we pay attention to pay enough attention in the right way. That's it. First, which ones, and then what? How do we do them? And that's still. But I think that it can be reduced. The problem is reduced by a really good needs analysis, so that you know much better. You've got a much better take rather than, you know, sticking your finger in it or getting some bloody, you know, epiphanous, you know, visit from the, it'll kill me. That's about 5 times I've mentioned that. Anyway, so that's one thing. The other thing, of course, that everybody goes on about is a focus on form.
Yeah.
and here is a huge difference between long and those who use course books, that long really doesn't approve of presenting grammar.
Yeah.
Saying today we're going to look at the present perfect. So this chopping up the language into bits and present, that's the kind of real no-no. That's the real anathema, you know, you must do. And that's the one that, when it comes down to pedagogical procedures, that's the most interesting. You know, how far, you know, Mike Long was watching you, you know, he'd say, it's up to you, it's your context. If they're adults, if they're thing, and they, you know, they like being told about stuff, and somebody's asked them, but he still wouldn't like you to say, okay, we're going to do the present perfect. He wouldn't like it. and it's interesting that in our courses, this second one, a lot of the teachers kind of insisted, I've got to do it. You know, for sort of face value, teachers, students expect it, their boss expects it. Mm-hmm. And if they really cut it out, the students get all nervous, you know, why aren't we doing any grammar? And Excuse, sorry. Hello. Ah, estás en la puerta. Okay, okay, 10 minutos. 2 minutos, vale. I've got a bloody packet arriving from voila. Can we? Yeah, I'm really sorry, but let's do it. We'll do another one with. We're doing another one tomorrow.
Yeah.
If you fancy coming along to that one, we'll.
Unfortunately, I'm teaching at that time, so I can't. But perhaps I'll be able to pick it up on the recording when.
And I'll try not to mention.
All right, sir. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Take care and talk to you soon.
Have a good day, sir.
You too.
Bye. Ciao.